Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, brought to you from the San Francisco Hilton Hotel. I am Skip Rhodes, president of the Commonwealth Club and your chairman today. It is my pleasure to welcome the listeners of WRAS-FM in Atlanta, Georgia, one of more than 225 radio stations nationwide carrying America's longest-running radio program. We also welcome the crew of PlexisNet here today to digitally record our program for viewing on the Commonwealth Club website. We invite all our listeners and viewers here and on radio to visit us on our website at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now, here to introduce our guest speaker this afternoon is Dr. Elaine Batchelor, Vice President of the California Healthcare Foundation. Dr. Batchelor.
Thank you and good afternoon. I'm so pleased to be here today for what promises to be a very interesting discussion of the health challenges for a new century. The California Healthcare Foundation is proud to be a partner in the new speaker series being launched this afternoon with the Commonwealth Club. The foundation is committed to promoting a thoughtful discussion of health policy issues in California, and there is no organization better suited to help provide that discussion than the Commonwealth Club of California. It is our hope that this speaker series will facilitate a deeper understanding of the healthcare issues of the day and allow us all to learn from the speakers and from each other in the months to come. Joining us today to launch this healthcare series is a distinguished guest who has been a steward of public health for well over two decades. As director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Dr. Jeffrey Copeland has been charged with promoting health and quality of life by preventing and controlling disease, injury, and disability, a mission he was committed to well before he was appointed to his current position. Throughout his career, Dr. Copeland has waged wars against smallpox, AIDS, cancer, sexually transmitted diseases, environmental health hazards, and has been instrumental in focusing attention on health problems associated with tobacco use. Dr. Copeland played a major role in establishing national immunization policies and increasing childhood immunization rates in this country. Under his leadership, chronic disease prevention and control also became a national public health priority. Dr. Copeland is a graduate of Yale University, Mount Sinai School of Medicine, and the Harvard School of Public Health. He is a board certified in internal medicine and preventive medicine. He was appointed to his position at the CDC in October 1998, at which point he became responsible for administering national programs to prevent and control diseases and environmental health problems and responding to infectious and environmental public health emergencies. Dr. Copeland's agency is also responsible for consulting with state and local health departments and for the collection, analysis, and dissemination of health statistics in an effort to improve the public health of the nation. In his tenure as director of the CDC, Dr. Copeland has provided strong leadership and direction in pursuit of the center's mission while preparing for the public health challenges that lie ahead. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome me. Join me in welcoming Dr. Jeffrey Copeland.
Thank you, Dr. Batchelor. Good afternoon. We've just completed a century of tremendous accomplishment. While aspects of our degree of social or political evolution can be debated, improvements are obvious in the areas of the role of women, civil rights, and health care coverage for the elderly. However, there's no question that the achievements of science and technology have been spectacular over this century. The computer revolution, faster modes of transport, and improved modes of communication. Not to mention vinyl siding, 8-track stereo, saran wrap, and dental floss. In my field of public health, the achievements of the 20th century dwarf those accumulated in the previous 19, and these are achievements that provoke little disagreement and have a minimum of the untoward side effects of advances in other fields. such as the pollution, injuries, impact on urban design, and effect on physical fitness of the automobile, the threat of nuclear weapons, and the insufferable burden of having to listen to cellular phone conversations in all public places. A person born in 1900 could expect to live, on average, to the age of 45. Today, life expectancy is nearly 80 years. Of the 35 years of lifespan we have gained, about 5 have been attributed to advances in clinical medicine, and the other 30 to improvements in sanitation, health education, the development of effective vaccines, and other public health advances. As the eminent British historian at the Wellcome Institute, Roy Porter, has observed, the retreat of the great lethal diseases was due more to urban improvements, superior nutrition, and public health than to curative medicine. I don't mean to minimize the phenomenal and exciting contributions of clinical medicine and technology. We can and should expect great things from the exploration of the frontiers of biomedical science. Many of these advances will come from this city and people in this room. But I would argue that for the population as a whole, the less visible contributions of public health have historically yielded a disproportionate payoff in longevity and quality of life. Last year at CDC, we made a list of the top 10 public health achievements of the 20th century. I'll just list them for you briefly. Vaccinations. More than 97% of the cases of childhood illness that are vaccine preventable have been decreased over the course of the century. Healthier mothers and babies, the rates of infant mortality and maternal mortality, very high at the beginning of the century, have markedly diminished. We have safe contraception and family planning, a safer, uncontaminated food supply, fluoridation of the drinking water with a marked effect on oral health, the control of infectious diseases through antibiotics and sanitation, the decline in deaths from heart disease and stroke between the 20 years from 1972 to 1992, deaths from heart disease have decreased by 51%. The recognition of tobacco use as a health hazard and the turning around of the tobacco epidemic. Motor vehicle safety has increased. Between 1966 and 1990, the use of seat belts, airbags, safer cars and roads, enforcement of drunk driving and other laws have saved an estimated 243,000 lives in this country alone. And safer workplaces. In 1900, one out of every 28 railroad employees was injured on the job, and one out of every 400 died on the job. We are proud of these achievements and the progress they represent. However, embedded in this progress is a great deal of unfinished business. We have not applied our knowledge and experience as comprehensively or as equitably as we should. In addition, many, if not most of our achievements, have been unevenly distributed among our population. There are marked disparities in health outcomes by race, ethnicity, and socioeconomic status. These disparities are unacceptable on moral grounds as well as for the more pragmatic economic reasons. Let me provide an example of such uneven distribution of health status, comparable to having the equivalent of a developing country within our own borders. In 4 contiguous counties in South Dakota, the life expectancy for Native American males is 56.5 years. That's comparable to the life expectancy for men in countries like Bangladesh and the Sudan. So as we look ahead to this new century, we might consider our health challenges from the following 3 perspectives. 1, those that we can have a major impact on now by applying what we already know. 2, those for which we need more knowledge and technical know-how in order to effect an improvement. And then 3, those we haven't even thought of yet. They are unanticipated, unrecognized, or ones that will be created by future events. Let's consider each of these in turn. The first perspective is applying what we know now. To give you an idea of what we could achieve in the next few decades by applying what we already know, let me pose the following question. What would our health indicators look like if we achieved the best rates possible for some of the leading health problems affecting Americans? There are many dozens of examples to choose from. I'd like to concentrate on two for this discussion. One, preventing diseases caused by tobacco, and two, preventing the complications of diabetes. First, let's look at tobacco. Tobacco use represents a significant health problem around the world. In the United States alone, tobacco use is responsible for 430,000 deaths each year. In the past 40 years, we indeed have come a long way. In the mid-1960s, over 40% of the population smoked. The figure was even higher for males, 60% of whom smoked, including the Surgeon General and other physicians. It seems incredible to me today to think back on my own training when sitting at a nursing station in the hospital I trained at, a distinguished teaching hospital, or in a conference room, the room would be filled with smoke. All of the attending physicians and the house staff would be smoking on pipes or cigarettes or sometimes cigars. That is no longer the case today. Indeed, if I were probably giving this talk to you 25 or 30 years ago, this room would be filled with smoke as well. Today, prevalence rates have dropped to a national average of 25%. California is one of the leaders in reducing smoking rates. At 19%, your prevalence rates are the second lowest in the nation. If the entire country had smoking rates as low as California's, we would eventually prevent 86,000 premature smoking deaths each year. I say eventually because the decades-long lag between smoking initiation and the manifestation of the diseases caused by smoking, cancer and heart disease, occur later in life. Each of these smokers who would otherwise have died from a tobacco-related disease would gain an average of 10 to 12 years of life. That's 10 to 12 years of enjoying retirement, seeing children grow up and start their own families, getting to know grandchildren, and so on. And as many of you know from witnessing these diseases in your own families, a tobacco-induced end of life can be particularly painful for patients and their families alike. How has California achieved these low rates, and what should the rest of the country emulate? There are still a few salient features that distinguish your tobacco control programs from others. These are higher tobacco taxes. They're higher in California than in all but two other states. Creative and effective anti-tobacco advertising, and smoke-free workplaces, restaurants, and bars. Other states that have followed your lead with comprehensive tobacco control programs have also documented declines in tobacco consumption. The late Jerry Garcia, local cultural hero and national icon of pop culture of the Grateful Dead, once said that he had an easier time quitting his heroin habit than quitting smoking. And indeed, he never did succeed in giving up cigarettes. On the individual level, we now have better medical tools to help people quit, such as nicotine patches and new drugs that counter nicotine's effect on brain chemicals. Yet California's experience shows that it is a comprehensive package of public policies, changes in social norms, and health education that work in tandem to reduce smoking levels and, more importantly, encourage people to avoid this deadly habit altogether. Let me turn from smoking to another example of the benefits of applying what we know. Different rates of diabetes amongst different ethnic groups in the United States. When we study diabetes among racial groups in the United States, the lowest diabetes mortality rates are among Asian Americans. Still, if whites, African Americans, Native Americans, and Hispanics all had the same age-specific diabetes mortality rates as those of Asian Americans, we would avoid over 19,000 deaths each year. This represents a 30% decline in diabetes deaths and a saving of 360,000 years of life. These differences are also striking for the complications of diabetes. These include kidney failure, amputations of legs damaged by poor circulation, and blindness. African Americans have a fourfold higher risk of developing kidney failure than whites and a threefold higher risk for lower extremity amputation than whites. Some of you may have seen the recent PBS special on Ella Fitzgerald and have learned, as I did, that she had both legs amputated because of complications from diabetes. Preventable cases of diabetes and its complications represent the vexing problem inherent in many chronic diseases, including heart disease. In many cases, we can prevent or treat these diseases, but in order to do so, we need to persuade people to make changes in diet and physical activity while seeking medical care and monitoring the disease progression. These changes are psychologically difficult and present formidable barriers for individuals and health systems alike. While genetic predisposition may play a role in type 2 diabetes, its onset and severity can be modified by diet and activity. Complications can be reduced by addressing these risk factors, achieving blood pressure control, and avoiding tobacco use. The second perspective on health challenges in the 21st century involves acquiring new knowledge and applying it. We are currently in the midst of a major expansion in resources dedicated to biomedical research. We can expect in the decades to come advances that permit us to detect diseases or even risks of diseases, such as breast cancer and diabetes, earlier and more accurately. We can expect better therapies for a wide range of microorganisms, including HIV and other viruses. We hope to acquire new vaccines for HIV, TB, malaria, and dengue. We also hope to achieve a much better understanding of the cause of and risk factors for many diseases, including Alzheimer's and chronic fatigue syndrome. We tend to think of these research efforts in narrow subcellular or molecular terms, and we need that, but we also need new knowledge in the behavioral sciences to allow for major improvements in health. Perhaps one of the best examples is the current epidemic of obesity. One of the risk factors for diabetes, obesity, is also a factor in other premature deaths. Obesity means having a body mass index, or BMI, of over 30, or in common parlance, having approximately 30 pounds extra weight. Obesity has reached epidemic proportions in this country. Between 1991 and 1998, in less than a decade, the proportion of obese people in the United States has increased 50%, from 12% to 17.9%. This trend is alarming, particularly the increase in childhood obesity. Obesity is much less common among college graduates than among the rest of the population. But a college education is a surrogate for whatever the real cause of that difference is. It may be income or lifestyle advantages that may provide the social determinants of diet, physical activity, etc., that may make that difference in excess weight. For example, a recent survey of American adults found that 37% of college graduates participate in regular physical activities, while only 18% of people who did not graduate from high school did so. This is quite a departure from the early years of this century, when lower-income people incorporated more physical activity into their daily lives through labor and walking. Currently, nearly 248,000 deaths among adults each year are attributed to obesity. That's 11.6% of all deaths in this country. If prevalence rates were the same for everyone as they are for college graduates, a quarter of these deaths could be averted. At an average of 25 years of life lost per person, we would save nearly 1.5 million life years each year. What's going on? Why is this epidemic happening at this time? I believe that an increasingly rushed culture of convenience, along with flawed urban design and the proliferation of fast food and snack food marketing, have converged to create this epidemic. The technological advances that brought us automation, TV, satellites, and urban sprawl have also removed many routine sources of physical activity from our daily lives and from the lives of our children. In the Steve Martin movie L.A. Story, there's a scene in which Steve Martin gets in his car and drives about 30 feet to his next-door neighbor's house. Sadly, this is not too far from the truth for many of us. This is particularly true for children who watch more TV, have less physical education in their schools, don't play outside or walk or ride their bikes. 60% of overweight children between the ages of 5 and 10 already have at least one risk factor for heart disease. 20% of these overweight children have two or more risk factors, such as high cholesterol, for heart disease. 75% of children in the United States live within 1 mile of their schools, but only 25% of these children walk or bicycle to school. What can we do? Well, we can take some steps right now. Healthcare providers can counsel their overweight and obese patients. Workplaces can offer healthier food choices and opportunities for their workers to engage in physical activity. Schools can offer not only more physical activity, but the types of activities offered can encourage children to form lifelong daily habits of exercise. Urban planners and residents and decision makers in communities can push for more sidewalks, bike paths, and other safe alternatives to cars. And parents can encourage their children to get away from screens and monitors and out in the yards and parks. Basically, we need a significant societal change in our attitudes and practices toward food, physical activity, transportation, and urban design. However, we need more information about successful approaches to prevent excess weight gain and promote physical activity. For some public health challenges, such as obesity and lack of physical activity, and other ones, such as violence, it is not enough to apply what we now know. We must also gain new knowledge, particularly regarding behavioral and policy research, and seek a change in societal norms and public policies. The third perspective on our health challenges is anticipating the unknown and preparing for the unanticipated. Of course, the unknown threats to health seem the most daunting, since they could take so many forms, ranging from bioterrorist attacks to environmental disasters to the ramifications of an increasingly older population. This reminds me of a telegram from a grandmother. Well, it can't be a grandmother. It has to be my grandmother because it has to be a Jewish grandmother. And the telegram is, "Begin worrying, details to follow." At CDC, we have begun worrying about bioterrorism, and we are working to be prepared for any number of scenarios. Our best protection is a strong public health infrastructure that includes sophisticated laboratory surveillance and communication networks that enable us to respond quickly and effectively to any number of threats. Given the recent history of bioterrorist events in Japan and Oregon, and the presence of malevolent, angry individuals and groups bent on terrorist acts, future events are quite possible and may be likely. A wide variety of biological or chemical agents could be used, singly or in combination. While many defense experts worry about a single large bioterrorist event, we at CDC are equally concerned about a series of small events resembling a routine outbreak of a hard-to-identify infectious disease. Imagine a few cases in South San Francisco, a few in Fresno, a few more in Walnut Creek, and 10 more a week later in Yuba City. Your county health departments, working with the state and CDC, will be responsible for recognizing these unusual health events and fitting them together into a puzzle that makes sense. We will need sharp surveillance, rapid diagnostic tests, links between public health and medical care providers, and state-of-the-art communication systems. We'll be acting fast, trying to figure out the source, food, water, air, individuals. We'll use the latest science and test the limits of our systems. We must be prepared because the faster we act, the more lives can be saved. The good news is that we've started rebuilding state and local detection systems in California and throughout the country. And these systems will serve us not only for bioterrorism preparedness, but in detecting and controlling emerging infectious diseases naturally occurring. New and emerging diseases will continue to challenge the health system in this new century. Bugs are tenacious and happy followers of a Darwinian worldview. They are fruitful and multiply and adapt in the process. They develop resistance to antibiotics. As the outbreak of West Nile encephalitis in New York reminded us last fall, They migrate with the birds. We need to make great efforts to stay ahead. While we would like to be prepared for all of the challenges that lie ahead, we know from history that we cannot anticipate everything. If we had this very meeting for our March 24th, 1900, we would have missed many, if not most, of the challenges that lead us to our 20th century achievements. Tobacco wasn't being mass-produced or marketed, women didn't smoke, and with few exceptions, tobacco use was seen as having no ill health effects. In 1900, fluoride wasn't even associated with strong teeth, and dentistry wasn't a profession. In 1900, there were 4,000 automobiles on the road, and auto safety wasn't an issue. In 1900, contraception wasn't a suitable topic for public discourse, probably not even for private intercourse. And Legionnaire's disease, HIV, and hantavirus were unknown. Dementias were not appreciated as a great health issue, in part because people died in what we would consider middle age. My point is that we can and must anticipate the challenges of the future while recognizing that we cannot predict today what will turn out to be the greatest health threats of this new century. True preparation, however, means that we can adapt to the unknown challenges ahead, using our scientific tools and public will to find solution to these new threats to health. Benjamin Franklin was a Renaissance man in a colonial outfit. We in public health chant a mantra from his Poor Richard's Almanac, the well-worn, "An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure." Franklin was also an advocate for and a practitioner of vaccination for smallpox. But I'd like to consider another of his aphorisms today as we consider where we are and where we're going in the public's health. That's early to bed, early to rise, makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise. Franklin recognized that health and wealth are interrelated. It's hard to earn a living, to do well at one's studies, to be entrepreneurial while in poor health. This fact is now recognized by the World Bank as it supports health programs as bases for economic development in developing countries around the world. Being of higher socioeconomic class makes one likely to be of better health status, a relationship well documented by the work of Professor Len Syme right here at University of California at Berkeley. Herman Biggs was the health officer of New York City in 1910 and recognized these relationships then. He stated that improvement in the public's health can be purchased if that society is willing to make the expenditure. That equation is still true. As we invest more and more in medical and scientific technology, what are our goals? Do we want to push our lifespans as far as possible? Or do we want to prevent the rarest deaths? There are many ways to configure our health system and the outcomes we expect of it, but we do have choices to make. For families faced with those rarest diseases, it is understandable that one life saved is worth a comprehensive and expensive screening program. From a public health perspective, I see a moral and practical imperative for applying equitably within society that which we know, as well as the new knowledge we will gain in the future. I'm in favor of what Jim Fries at Stanford has proposed as our broadest health objective, having a healthy, well-functioning life until a ripe old age, and then a quick, painless exit. We do have new goals for the nation set for the year 2010, and they don't include living to a Methuselahian age, but they do try to improve quality of life and to eliminate health disparities between populations. I like to think that we can be healthy, wealthy, and wise. We are the wealthiest nation in history. We need to show the wisdom of sharing equitably the tremendous gains in health and longevity that we have accrued in the past century. We can do better, and most importantly, we know how to do better. California, in its early, aggressive, and effective approach to tobacco control and prevention, is a model for the nation on what can and should be done in many areas of public health. 50 years from now, our children will be considering the health achievements of the first half of the 21st century, What will they find? Will it be a rich and informative scientific literature whose benefits have been incompletely realized, and a country whose economic polarization is paralleled by widely disparate health outcomes? Or will they find a society that has invested in knowledge while addressing the moral basis for that investment by applying our skills and knowledge to all our population and making disease prevention a major focus of our health system? As a nation, we are wealthy. If we invest in public health, we all can be comparably healthy and then together get healthier still. If we make this investment, future generations will judge us as having been wise. I'll leave the early to bed part up to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Jeffrey Copeland, Director of the Center for Disease Control. Now, Skip Rhodes, President of the Commonwealth Club, will conduct the question and answer session.
Thank you, Dr. Elaine Batchelor of the California Healthcare Foundation. And now, Dr. Copeland, we have a ton of questions for you. So if you'd return here, please, we'll start in. First question, what is CDC doing in tobacco control?
Our Office on Smoking and Health has been very active. We contribute to the Surgeon General's reports on tobacco control. We have very active programs in youth tobacco prevention. We are working both domestically and internationally. Domestically, we work with all state health departments. This past year put together, I think, something that has been a very useful set of documents and materials for state health departments to help determine what are appropriate programs to use for the dollars that might be available from the tobacco settlement with the large tobacco companies, and what are appropriate levels of investment necessary to make a difference in those populations. We're working with the World Health Organization and the World Bank overseas to try to retard the spread of our epidemic of tobacco use to other countries. And so we've got a lot of programs going on.
Follow-up question to that. This week, the U.S. Supreme Court told the FDA it could not regulate tobacco as a drug. Do you think this decision will have any effect on tobacco use and your work, and what should Congress do now?
I don't think it will have the effect that it would have had 5 years ago. The country has changed markedly and steadily over the last decade, and we've turned a corner on our tolerance, I think, of widespread tobacco use in public and our view of it as a serious health hazard. I think what's striking about the Supreme Court decision is, if you look at the majority and minority opinions, there was total agreement, and one of the first statements from Justice O'Connor's majority opinion was that tobacco is a major preventable cause of death and disability in this country. So that I think all justices agreed on that. I think that there is also bipartisan support in Congress for doing something about tobacco in terms of regulation by the FDA. So I think we have gone through a sea change in this country, and that the impact of the Supreme Court decision alone will not deter us from continuing to gain further victory over tobacco use in the country.
This questioner wants to know, how would you rate the widespread availability of health care coverages in terms of major accomplishments in the 20th century beyond the factors that doctors no longer make house calls?
There's a lot in that question. We don't have adequate widespread health care coverage in this country. There's a significant portion of our population that does not have coverage, and another significant proportion that is undercovered, and that is something that has to be addressed sooner or later. A big advance in the century, of course, is the coverage for our older population, and in the last few years, we have begun to address the needs of children to provide health care coverage, and we need to fill in the further gaps. The second part of that question?
Second part was, what do you think the major accomplishment, and beyond the fact doctors no longer make house calls?
I hadn't realized they had stopped making house calls. Our healthcare system is going through marked changes, as everyone who lives here and has had an experience with the healthcare system knows, and will probably continue to for several years to come. And this is true all over the world. But I think one amongst several positive aspects of these changes is a recognition of the value of prevention in preserving our health and improving our health. And we see this trend continuing in all aspects of the healthcare delivery system.
What are the likely public health effects, good or bad, from genetic engineering of foodstuffs?
I don't know. my impression is that that has been carefully looked at, that there is no evidence that I'm aware of that genetic engineering has any untoward effects in the foods that it's provided with. And I guess one thing that I've been struck by is while there are certain foods that we closely identifying as having been genetically altered, from what I've heard from people in the agricultural world, many of the foods that we've eaten for many years have had very similar processes attached to them that we haven't thought about or been concerned about at all. And I think what's striking is that the food supply we have now in the year 2000 in terms of its variety, the healthy alternatives that presented to us, the abundant supply of vegetables and fruits through all seasons of the year, and fortification of some of the food items that we have prevented, really present us with the best possible dietary choices that we've ever had in mankind's history. And the striking diseases of the early part of the 20th century that were rife in many parts of this country, diseases that we now think of as archaic and part of ancient history texts, pellagra, rickets, wide variety of vitamin deficiencies no longer are trouble us, both because of our food supply and the fortification of some of the foods.
More and more, it seems that the population at large requests antibiotics from their doctors when they don't feel well. To what extent is this creating a string of diseases resistant to antibiotics?
Antibiotic resistance is a major public health problem and challenge for us in this country and around the world. It stems from a variety of reasons, one of them the inherent biology of microorganisms, which is that their goal is to survive. And when they see in their environment a toxic substance to them that's doing them in, they will evolve in a way that ensures their continued survival and make that chemical, that antibiotic that's in their environment, no longer toxic to them. And we've seen this happen again and again. And it probably started happening within a few hours after Sir Alexander Fleming first started using penicillin. However, we have not behaved in a way that we have been frugal maintainers of the treasure that's been given to us. And so over the years, there has been markedly inappropriate and excess use of antibiotics. And it's been caused both because of public expectations and consumer demand, and also because we in the healthcare profession have probably been too passive in our approval of using antibiotics when they really weren't necessary. And that's changing. We at the CDC are working closely with the American Academy of Pediatrics, for example, to both educate patients and describe the situations where antibiotics are useful and needed and save them for those circumstances so they aren't less useful when we really need them, and also working with physicians to ensure that we all understand what the best uses and times for antibiotic use are.
How do you evaluate the contributions of the Internet to America's health, and what are the developments that you foresee in e-health for the future?
I think it's a wonderful advance in health. It gives everyone with access to the Internet the opportunity to learn immense amounts of information much more easily and efficiently than we and they could have before. For us in CDC, it means that we have changed our constituencies. In the old days at CDC, our constituents were state health departments and county health departments, and to some degree, the medical community. But now, in many ways, we have direct relationships with millions of citizens and consumers and people interested in health who can gain access to our website and do. We have a very frequently used website. striking thing occurred to me in India in December, where I was with a group of Indian officials concerned about environmental health, and happened to say to them, have any of you visited us in Atlanta before? And of the group of 20, two or three had for courses or for state visits of one kind or another. And one person who had their hand up, I said, well, when did you come? And he said, well, I've actually never been in Atlanta. I said, but you say you have visited CDC. He said, oh, I visit it several times a day. And he, from his relatively provincial town in the middle of India, he tunes in on the website several times a day. So it's a network and a web and public health and in common issues that we didn't have before. It's a terrific tool.
Dr. Copeland, a follow-up to that. How does the average American know if the information on these websites is reliable? And is CDC working on this issue? And if so, how?
We may be the epidemic police, but we are not the internet police. We try to ensure that our website has accurate information, has complete information, and has material of interest to a wide audience, including we are currently initiating a Spanish language part of our website, and we're constantly looking at ways to make us more consumer useful and friendly and ensure that our information is up to date, obviously, and accurate. But what one finds on a variety of sites on the web is, you've all had your own experiences in looking at, I think one has to look at it like when you read a book. You have to be critical. Those of you who are scientists or in the medical field, when you read a scientific paper, you have to question it. When those of you who are not in the medical field read an article about health in a magazine or see a piece on a TV show or the radio, how do you know that what's being reported is accurate and true? So you have to bring a certain level of both skepticism, healthy skepticism, and ask certain questions of yourself and then people who provide health care with you. So it's second opinions for information are probably just as important as second opinions for whether you need surgery or a diagnostic test.
What is known about the increasing incidence of breast cancer in the United States, now at 1 out of every 8 women? And what can and should be done to reverse this trend?
We are eager to see improvements in both screening tests and early detection for breast cancer. Treatment modalities have improved somewhat, but we've still got a ways to go. But here we're back to the theme I mentioned earlier of applying what we know. Many women in this country still do not get routine mammogram screening. Mammograms have been shown over and over again to reduce mortality from breast cancer by 30%. That's a third. If we had a vaccine that reduced the outcome of a lethal disease by a third, everyone would rush to get that vaccine. We have a technique that works that is sometimes inconvenient and sometimes uncomfortable, but not terribly expensive and needs to be done and needs to be done regularly.
What is your plan for improving our terrible infant mortality rate when compared to other industrialized nations? Do you see an increased role for nurse midwives and lactation specialists?
Our infant mortality rate is variable by populations within the U.S. Overall, our rate has come down markedly throughout the decades of the 20th century. However, for some groups, for example, African Americans, the rate is markedly higher than for other parts of our population and too high. We're engaged in numerous studies and numerous projects and attempted interventions to try to see what the causes of that are and to reduce it. But it has been frustrating that we have not identified key factors that we can change yet that will make a difference. And we have ongoing studies looking at it, but it remains an intractable problem of lowering infant mortality rates in some parts of the country.
Could you update us on what the Chronic Disease Center is doing?
The Chronic Disease Center at CDC was put together, that's about 12 years now, and covers a range of health issues, but they include heart disease and diabetes, cancer screening, detection, et cetera. Some of the exciting things that are going on there currently are an expansion of our breast and cervical cancer screening program, and the president in his budget request for this year, for the first time, has asked for treatment support, resources to pay for treatment for that screening program, which is a terrific advance. We are moving into a number of communities with heart disease control programs. The U.S. has invested a lot in learning what are the risk factors for heart disease and how on a community and population basis can we make a change that makes a difference. And we've made a lot of advances in that, but we're trying to further that through work with state health departments. One of the things that the Chronic Disease Center is doing, I think is very exciting, is a particular series of projects involved with trying to eliminate racial disparities, particularly targeting minority communities in around the country. There are several of these projects actually in California and in the Bay Area. And they focus on certain specific health issues such as infant mortality, heart disease, diabetes, immunizations, breast and cervical cancer.
In your
And HIV/AIDS.
Thank you. In your speech, you hit home with a number of our audience members on the area of bioterrorism. So let me ask several questions in that area. We read a great deal about bioterrorism and biological warfare. What is the role of the CDC in safeguarding the American public from these agents, and how prepared are we?
We are getting better prepared, but we aren't prepared now. The range and types of threats that we can be presented to us are so large and so different, we are not in shape yet, I think, to deal as well as we might. But what we've been doing for the past year and are doing very actively with a lot of effort and resources behind it is making work in a number of areas. One, we're trying to improve our own capability at a national level at CDC to identify and recognize what the threat is when it occurs, and that includes beefing up the numbers of our folks who are capable of going out and investigating these things at a local level, our medical detectives, if you will, beefing up our laboratory capabilities to add chemicals and biological agents that we either had not known about before or we had stopped testing for because we didn't think they were likely to occur in the U.S. So we have greater capabilities there. We've created a laboratory at CDC specific for when these unknown possible bioterrorist events occur, to have them come into that lab and to begin the process of identification. We are working with state and local health departments to beef up their capabilities, and those are extremely important. In this issue, you are only as safe as your neighboring county. And indeed, your neighboring county is not just Contra Costa or Santa Clara or whatever it is within stone's throw of here. It's Fulton County in Georgia, or Suffolk County on Long Island, because with travel, with migration, we are only as strong as everybody else around us. So we're trying to beef up the capabilities of local health departments. And what does that mean? That means when you go to your local health department, they need to have either the laboratory capability or a place to send laboratory specimens. They need the capability of identifying some of these health issues and diseases. They need to have good relationships with medical care provider community, including emergency rooms and infectious disease doctors. Local docs have to raise their capabilities and interest and knowledge when they see something of what unusual thing might it be and begin to think along those lines of different diseases that might not otherwise have been predicted. The communication capabilities of local health departments and state health departments have to be upgraded. Many of our local health departments do not report electronically. Many of our local health departments are not on the internet with secure lines to send information, nor can they communicate with each other. And a key piece of this picture is what I indicated earlier, is that it's one thing to have 12,000 cases in one site. That'll bring us all running and quickly know that something unusual is going on. But at the earliest stage of one of these problems, you'll have 3 cases in one place and 4 cases somewhere else and 5 cases 2,000 miles away. And what we need to be able to do is identify something peculiar in those 2 cases and then see that they share characteristics with 3 cases somewhere else. And only through a good communication system can we do that, and we are not there yet, but we're working hard towards it. And then the final piece of what we're up to is stockpiling materials. We have a contract, and we have at the moment $40 million worth of materials, various antibiotics versus various antidotes to chemical toxins. We have seeking vaccines at the moment as well to have on in storage, ready to ship out within 24 hours to sites where this might be needed. So there's a lot going on, and I think it's worthwhile our investing in this.
This questioner asks, on the radio this morning, the news talked about a soft tissue infection epidemic here in San Francisco. Can you comment on this?
I haven't read it, and I'm just not familiar with it, so I can't offer.
What is the role of the CDC in combating diseases outside the United States? Clearly, we cannot afford a world with those with good health and those without simply as a result of birthplace.
I think we should no longer think of domestic illness and illness that's of an international origin. Diseases that we once thought of as tropical diseases are not of interest to us. Have become of intense interest to us for a variety of reasons. There's immense amount more travel. There's lots more people. And people from here are going elsewhere, and people from elsewhere are coming here. In addition, the various agents that can bring things elsewhere bring them. Birds can go from one place to another. Bugs can go from one place to another. The United States was once endemic for malaria in many of its parts. And that time long ago was up to 1950. The mosquito that carries malaria exists throughout the Southeast, exists in parts of California, the Midwest. Yellow fever was a common epidemic along the eastern seaboard right up through the start of the 20th century. We see new diseases occurring. The West Nile in New York had never been seen there before. So these are all have international ramifications. But things go the other way. We, the major producers and owners of tobacco companies around the world, see our products going to other places. The lifestyle that we've promulgated of being sedentary, having excess calories and excess fat, is being exported, if you will, to other parts of the world as well. So it's a two-way street on healthy and unhealthy risks being transmitted around. In addition, we have an immense amount to learn from other places. The major programs in heart disease control, many of them started in Australia, in North Korea and Finland, in Wales. And so we have things we can learn from other people. And so our view at CDC is we try to do a lot of international work in everything from influenza to vaccines to HIV prevention to tobacco to heart disease to diabetes. And our view is that we don't have one of exchange one piece of technical support, one collaboration in which we don't learn or gain more from that interaction than we've been able to offer someone else. So we're strong advocates of global health activities.
This audience member asks, what about joint pain? Is there ever going to be any type of injection or pill to take away pain? And at the bottom, with exclamation point, thank you.
Whoever asked that, could you let me know when you find out? Because I've got a left knee that could really use some of those benefits. It's not an area that I have expertise in except as a fellow sufferer, but we hope that something occurs in the clinical and biomedical world soon. I'd say UCSF is probably more likely to find an answer for you than CDC.
Why are so many younger people now starting to smoke? How can this disturbing trend be reversed? Also, how do we justify the hard sell on tobacco exports?
There's nothing magic in this. The trend can be reversed through very simple approaches. One, investment in it. The states that have put more money into their tobacco control programs, that have higher excise taxes, that have public awareness campaigns and health promotion campaigns designed by young people for young people, have lower rates of people taking up smoking than states that don't. And it's as simple as that. So the concept that we can't do anything about it is not true. We can do things about it, and California is a good example of places. Now, your question might be, how can people who hear this stuff want to smoke at all, given all the information we have in hand? That's more of a philosophic question. I think that, you know, we all do things that aren't necessarily always in our best interests. But what we want to do is lower that level considerably, and particularly in young people, involve role models, public relations campaigns, things in school, things outside of school, and price and policy, environmental issues, and enforcement issues to continue to drive those rates down to make it an unacceptable and undesirable habit. It's not intrinsically attractive. It's not an intrinsically, you don't smoke your first cigarette and say, this is great. What was I missing before? It takes a little while to get into it, and I think we need to build on that. Again, places that have made that investment have all done better than those that haven't.
We have been hearing more about hepatitis B. Is this new? If so, why are we seeing it now?
We have made tremendous advances on hepatitis B in the last couple of decades. We have a very effective vaccine, which is in widespread use. Possibly the concern is over hepatitis C, for which we don't have a vaccine as of yet, and which has enacted a toll on a part of our population during a period of time in which blood transfusions conveyed hepatitis C. That's no longer occurring, but one of our concerns is that people who had transfusions during a period of years past go back and get checked for this so they can realize what their status is, their serological status is for the disease.
Unfortunately, we've come to that time in our program when we have time for just one last question, and it's this. When you were young, you were reputed to be a fan of the Grateful Dead. You mentioned this and your story about Jerry Garcia. Do you still listen to the Dead's music?
I don't remember the answer to that. Not frequently, but I would say that, what is the song, A Shade of Gray, is a very good piece. Touch of Gray, thank you. I've gotten some help from the audience, in which there's a good reference to the aging process, and that song ought to be taken on as an anthem from by the AARP as part of their activity. So,
our thanks to Dr. Jeffrey Copeland, Director of the Centers for Disease Control, for joining us today. We also thank our audience here in San Francisco and those listening on radio. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the nation's oldest and largest public affairs forum, is adjourned.